know, there's going to be a house with Ifeh de Bosperat. Advocate Killian,
I'm trying to.
Just the boys have been there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. In 5 minutes, can you tell us about who you are, your value system, as well as experience and skills that you will bring to the office of your public advocate?
Thank you, Chair. I'm Advocate Ule Matsebo. Starting with my qualifications, values and experience, if I may refer. I graduated BUS from the University of Northwest, the Mafeking campus, in 1989, and later LLB, which was a senior degree at that time, from the same university in 1991. And then I went further to study LLM at Georgetown Law Center, Washington, D.C., which I graduated in 1994. And then later, I did advanced diploma certificate in labor relations with the University of Pretoria. So I started working in 1989 to date. All in all, that gives me 30 years work experience. However, I need to subtract the 2 years whereby I was studying LLM on a full-time basis in DC. And I also, in 1995, did a second LLM in human rights at Stellenbosch University, which I never completed. So I minus those 2 years. And then later, I also subtracted the 6 months whereby I was unemployed after they attended Stellenbosch. So all in all, we can speak about 27 years work experience. Where did it start? In 1989 to 1992, I was appointed as a military law officer with the S2M of Botswana Defense Force. That was my first job. But I need also to mention that prior to that, when I was doing BUS, I used to work with a firm of attorney called Malcolm Lyons Attorneys. They are specialists in road accident funds matters. I used to work there, you know, when I was a student doing BUS during my school holidays. The firm was based in Johannesburg, but they've now recently moved to Cape Town. So with my appointment as a military law officer, I was appointed as a civil claims specialist. I was also involved in boards of inquiry, preliminary investigations, and prosecutions at court martial. Later, I moved briefly to the S2L Botswana Justice as an assistant state law advisor, whereby I was responsible for drafting legal opinion and legislation. And I moved from there to 1993 to 1994 to do that LLM. Upon my return in June 1994 from the US, I was appointed as a lecturer at Vista Manigoli campus to lecture private law. I think it's now called Pretoria, it's joined to Pretoria University at the moment. In 1995, I mentioned that I was at Stellenbosch. And the first part of 1996, I was unemployed after Stellenbosch. And then November 1996, I was again appointed as a contract law lecturer at the University of Northwest, Mafeking campus, whereby I lectured law of contract to advanced law of contract to LLB students. I also lectured social welfare law to final year social work students. And from November 1996, I was appointed as the Deputy Director of Labor Relations by the Northern Cape Provincial Administration. Even at that level, I was Head of Labor Relations for the whole province. Then I moved to the Department of Mineral and Energy, where I was Head of Legal Services for a few months. I had four lawyers reporting to me. And then from August 1997 to 2007, appointed a researcher as a rank of principal state law advisor at the South African Law Reform Commission. I was a researcher there, responsible for research and writing. So in other words, that was 1997 to 2007, that was 10 years at the Law Commission. But two of those 10 years, I was seconded to Justice College from 2004 to 2006 as a lecturer. My responsibilities involved lecturing Domestic Violence Act, human rights was my main responsibility, and also sometimes I would teach on the recognition of Customary Marriages Act, since I was the researcher in that act. During my secondment to justice, I was also during that time concurrently seconded to train prosecutors when they establish an internal audit unit.
1 minute.
Okay, when I was responsible for training prosecutors, 2007 to 2014, I was appointed as senior state law advisor within the litigation unit of the Department of Justice, whereby we litigated on behalf of the state. 2015, I was appointed acting chief director within the chief litigating officer, whereby I was responsible for research. From 2016, I joined the bar to date. I felt privileged again, despite the fact that I was a litigator before, but because I wanted to be a member of the bar, I started by serving privilege with the Johannesburg Bar, moved to Pretoria, and I'm currently with Church Square Association Bar, where I currently am a member of the Bar Council. That's where I'm currently practicing. And I'm also a member of the Mental Health Review Board of SWANI. As a legal practitioner, in that we review, we protect the rights of users, we oversee mental institutions, and we also review decisions of head of health establishments.
Can you please confirm your disclosure in the questionnaire? Is there anything that you want the committee to know?
Yes, I can use that opportunity to come to my values, which are integrity, professionalism, excellence, hard work, loyalty.
Thank you very much. I think you are aware of the Concourse judgment of the EFF versus the Speaker of the National Assembly, the Democratic Alliance and others versus the Speaker of the National Assembly in 2016, which had a fundamental impact in the functioning of the Office of the Public.
By the way, what was the decision in that judgment? Okay. Before I talk to you, how it affected, because there's been many decisions and I can't say which one is actually what I'm talking about.
The
Kanda judgment. That is the judgment where the Constitutional Court unanimously decided that the powers of the public protector are binding. The powers of the public protector had a binding and legal effect. So in my view, how it impacted the office, it assisted in interpreting the role of the public protector.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, can I note hands? Honorable Swart, Honorable Mola, Honorable Jose, Honorable Mohammed, Honorable Jale, Honorable
thank you, Chair. Thank you for the submission and thank you for your CV. I just wanted to ask a few questions about good governance, given your vast experience advocate in the civil service. You worked for 19 years. What constructive action can the Office of the Public Protector take to ensure that there is good governance in the public service? What at the high standards of professional ethics, what could you do as Deputy Public Protector? And please, I must apologize for interrupting. Trying to keep your answers short because I've only got 5 minutes. Thank you.
Do you mind to rephrase your question?
Well, the constructive action that the Public Protector, one of its prime roles is to ensure that there's good governance mm-hmm. in the public sector.
Yes.
You've had experience.
Yes.
What? How would you enhance that?
I would enhance that is be proactive. Because, you know, the public protector can either be reactive or counteractive. But what I could do was to initiate investigations in areas that I see to be mainly areas of concern and write a report with recommendations.
Thank you. We also are aware of the high levels of corruption, and I'm sure you as an advocate are aware of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. Would you see yourself as a champion, an anti-corruption champion?
Most definitely, since it's one of the key areas of performance of the public protector, and since I will be supporting that role.
And how would you, as Deputy Public Protector, assist the public protector in ensuring that state departments, ministers even, right to the top, adhere to the remedial action proposed by a public protector?
To engage them, to encourage them. I know that recently the public protector did complain that there is no compliance. Some government departments do not comply. So if there is non-compliance, it's to report to the parliamentary committee, the parliament, and to encourage them to comply.
And how would you operate within that office, considering the financial constraints that the office operates under as well?
That's a big one, because, you know, as I was studying for this interview, I came across, I think the most important thing at this stage is to benchmark and to see how foreign developed jurisdictions have dealt with the challenge of budget constraints that lead to capacity challenges. And I think I like the model of Denmark, whereby they initiate, they pick on a number of cases, and they make recommendations to say, generally there's a problem in this area based on the number of cases that we have looked at, and this is what we're recommending, even training.
Thank you. And given those financial constraints, how would you advise the public protector which cases which are taken on review against the public protector should be defended or not, considering that 90% of the work would be deal with complaints and access to the public protector, and there are some high-profile cases that obviously cost a lot of money. Now, as an advocate, I'm talking about where the public protector is taken on review, that decision, which cases should be defended at substantial legal cost. But that's obviously a concern, that the escalation in legal costs, now that there's a binding implication, there are far more court cases.
There are court cases, and therefore, obviously, she has to be selective in her approach. And I would advise her to select cases that will develop our jurisprudence, because, you know, it's not all the time where you defend for the sake of defending. Most of the time you defend because you have a good case, number one. You believe you have a good case. So I want to believe that the public protector, when she writes a report, she's convinced that her report is correct. If she believes that she has a good case, then she can defend. If she believes that the case will develop jurisprudence, like the one that talked to the powers of the public protector, she can defend. Where there is a lack of clarity on a certain issue, she can defend.
Thank you, Chair. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much for monitoring the time.
Thanks, Chair. I will touch on one area which is work experience. Advocate Machalo, you have been appointed in 1989 as a military law officer.
Yes, sir.
Am I correct to say in 1989 South Africa was under the apartheid rule?
That is true.
Am I correct to say Botswana was a bantu stand led by the then Lucas Mangope?
That is correct.
Am I correct to say bandit scams generally were led by spies of the apartheid authoritarian?
That is correct.
Can you tell the committee what skills and expertise did you have in 1989 to be appointed by a Bantustan military wing?
Let me start by explaining, Honorable Member, that working at the Defense Force then, for me, it was not a political decision. It was an economic decision. It was immediately after the attempted coup, or the aborted coup, because there was a coup, if you remember very well, by the then Defense Force, which was aborted by South Africa. And thereafter, the salaries of the military and the defense, the Putazano was increased by 35%. So at that stage, for me, I just wanted to get a good paying job. It was not a political decision at all. I just needed, I needed to take care of my family, I needed to take care of myself, I needed to pay my loan, I just needed a job that would pay me well. And if you remember very well, the same defense force is the defense force that silenced AWP.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate Hisham Mohammed.
Thank you very much, Advocate Uchilo. Just a couple of questions from my side. In your view, is the Public Protector's Office a passive adjudicator between citizens and the state, or does the institution have more investigatory role requiring proactive citizens in certain circumstances?
She can be proactive or reactive.
Thank you. Also in your view, what would be, I'm sure you've looked at the annual report and the office as it is the last couple of years, or since it opened itself. What would you say the challenges or the risks that this office faces, and how would you suggest you mitigate it?
As I said, budgetary constraints that lead to capacity constraints, human resource, whether it's financial, resources, whether it's human resource or financial resource, that results in workload, because now the Office of a Public Protector is now very popular. People are aware of the office. So there is an increase of complaints that people bring to the office. Yes, and also another challenge is that one of non-compliance with the remedial action of the Public Protector.
Tell me, have you ever supervised subordinates or people that you work with?
I have supervised. When I was a deputy director of labor relations, I had four lawyers reporting to me. When I was head of legal services for mineral energy, I also had four lawyers reporting to me. Also, when I was acting chief director of research, my last appointment at Justice, there were researchers reporting to me.
At Justice, were you at the State Law Advisor's Office or where?
At Justice, I was at the Law Commission. I was at Justice College. Then I ended up being part of the litigating unit, which fell within the office of the Chief Litigating Officer. And even my role as Acting Chief Director was reported to the Acting CLO.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jordan.
Thanks, Jefferson. I also would like to continue the line of questioning that the Honourable Member abandoned. So the Public Protector is a chapter like that. It's like its origins flow directly from the Constitution. And those are stewards of our democracy.
Right.
So you go and work for a reactionary government because you want money.
Yes.
You choose money over the MNN fight for justice. Am I correct?
Well, when you are young, you make decisions like that.
Hector Peterson was younger than you in 89 when he died in 76.
When you are not conscientized, you make decisions like that.
So you were not conscientized?
Yes, I was not.
So how did you know that your decision is not political if you are not conscientized?
Because when I took a decision to apply for the defense force, it was not because I wanted to defend that regime. I just wanted to work.
So stewards of justice often choose higher values, not money.
We grow in our values, eh? But my values have changed.
Because
since then, as I said, I was younger. I was just motivated by having to work and put bread on the table.
So what is motivating you now? Why don't you go work elsewhere? Because here, you're going to find justice. You're going to have to confront people who are doing an injustice. You're going to have to defend the public against the abuse of power. What evidence do we have that you choose justice, not expediency?
The evidence that you have is with my other record, where I work. Currently, I oversee mental health institutions. If I'm to talk, I protect the rights of mental health care users. At the moment, and except for that, I do legal education in churches. When I was working for the Law Commission, and there was this progressive legislation that was produced daily, and I became aware that this legislation is meant for some people, and these people are not even aware of this legislation. Since then, I started to find...
Am I right that that's charity work? It's not a fight for justice. There's nothing opposing you. There's nothing threatening your life. There's nothing. When you're the public protector, you fight against the powerful, your family, your even your reputation and all of that. Justice. There's nothing at stake in these things you're saying. What evidence do we have that the expediency choice you made of a career in 89, which you so explained now, how do we know you're a fighter of justice?
Well, I am a fighter of justice. We fight differently. You know, some people toy. Some fight with their minds. Some fight with their pay. Some fight with their money.
What
they form a worthy couple.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's just like 5 minutes. So I know that some people fight with their legs, some with their hands, some with their hair, some with their mind.
Yes.
What evidence do I have that you fought for justice and you didn't do things because they were giving you a salary? Meaning, even when you're fighting for justice, as a lawyer, lawyers don't fight for justice, they get paid for it.
You know, even my current job where I overpay, where I oversee institutions, it's not worth it. I wouldn't say it's not worth the time. I do it out of passion. But really, to be paid $3.50 per hour, with my experience, I'm doing it for the love of my people. I'm doing it for the love of my country.
How old were you in 1989? Just my final question.
I turned 21 November 1988. So I was 21 years old.
Okay. Chairperson, the very, very last one. Am I still have time?
No, it should be the last one.
Okay. Yeah. So the position of the Deputy Public Protector, you will be working with Advocate Chilima Donzela, who at the moment, Mkweba. You'll be working with Advocate Mkweba.
Yes.
There is a lot of negative public review on her because of the many losses of cases, including the personal cost that the court gave to her. And they have very bad things to say about her. Can you give us your view of the performance of this office under her stewardship and what you think if you were to be appointed, what do you think should happen to sort of redirect, or are you happy with how she's been doing things, or the office has been doing things?
Well, I'll give you my prima facie view, not conclusive, in the sense that for me to make a comment about somebody's performance, I mean, even in a workplace, you have to assess. And when you do that performance assessment, you are presented with portfolio of evidence. And there are instances where even a person has to speak to the evidence that is provided. So I cannot willy-nilly make a judgment. That is why I'm saying the prima facie view. And I strongly want to believe that that is why even people that have to decide on the competency of a person have to make a factual inquiry first. It's then that you decide. So I'm trying to say I'm not in a position to conclusively decide on your performance. I cannot.
Thank you very much. Madam Jana.
Thank you, Chairperson. Advocate Pauline Watsela. Good morning.
Morning, Honourable Member.
Mm-hmm. On the questionnaire, your response on the questionnaire, you made mention of things that you think are the challenges that the country is facing.
Yes.
What are those challenges? You mentioned gender-based violence. According to you, there's a very serious problem.
That's correct.
Yes.
Honourable Member.
Yes, and I also think that even the country, myself, I think it's very, very, it's a very problematic issue. But my question on that one is that how would you go about ensuring that the public protection office makes a genuine impact on the lives of the ordinary people, of the ordinary South Africans, particularly on women and children?
Honourable Member, as I said earlier on, we all have different skills. And I think that we should all brighten the corner where we are. And for me, with gender-based violence, my role for many, many years, even before the current Domestic Violence Act, I've been conducting legal education on this issue, defining the concept, telling people how to access the protection order, and so on and so forth. So that will be my contribution.
Following up on that, with all the problems that the Office of the Public Protector is experiencing now, would you say, taking from the problems that we have in terms of gender, you know, all those patriarchy issues, would you say all these problems that she's experiencing, is it because she's a woman?
I don't think so. The public protector is a person and is an office, so I don't think it has got anything to do with a woman. A woman can be competent just like a man.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Any other the Constitution requires that the public protector must be always independent and impartial. What is your view on that one?
I agree 100%. Independence, impartiality. She must be able to perform her duties without fear, favor, and prejudice.
How would you address the situation when an organ of the state ignores or refuses to implement a remedial action when you are?
She has reported it to the National Assembly. I think we'll continue to do the same. And even mention it, even through the reporting, in her report.
How would you think that it is what is the mandate exactly of this public protector? Just give me please.
It's a Chapter 9 institution, and her mandate is to strengthen constitutional democracy.
In your assessment, in what areas has the public protector more successfully performed her mandate?
She's managed to keep a clean financial record. And I'm also aware that she's been appointed as a president of, I think, Ombudsman or Public Protector. I think that is a vote of confidence for her.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning.
Morning, Honourable Member.
Could you tell me, please, what your views or your understandings of the concept of the rule of law and your understanding of the concept of the due process.
Rule of law means that at all times we should abide by regulatory provisions, the law, the constitution, taking into account the Bill of Rights. And due process means that following proper procedures, observing the alteram partem rule, giving witnesses the right to cross-examine, and allowing them the right to legal representation.
Thank you. In the current setup in the Public Protector's Office, we're all aware that there are severe difficulties from staff between the Public Protector and the Deputy. He has told Parliament and South Africa generally that his position is one of being sidelined and doing work that really doesn't suit his qualification or the status of the Deputy Public Protector. What would you do if you found yourself in that position?
If I find myself in the same position, I will raise the issue with her. And if I don't get joy from raising the issues with her, I will raise it with the Parliamentary Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Another one.
Thank you, Chair. So you spent 10 years, minus the 2 years you were seconded to the Justice College at the South African Law Reform Commission, on what legislation did you work there?
Recognition of Customary Marriages Act. That's the main one that I worked with. Took a number of years. I was also involved with a drafting of something to do with decriminalizing prostitution. Those two that I can remember.
Okay. And you said that in terms of community involvement, you've been involved a lot with training in respect of the Domestic Violence Act.
Yes.
Processes around that. What's the big weaknesses in the current legislation?
Can you speak to your mic?
What's the big weaknesses in respect of the current Domestic Violence Act, given the fact that you have a legislative drafting background?
The big weakness? I'm not aware of any big weakness at the moment. The only problem which I have is that despite the fact that there will be instances where somebody is fitted with a protection order, they go back to the court to cancel it. Now that becomes a problem of victims. But even that, psychologists have made us aware that, you know, because when we're doing this domestic violence training, we also did social context, which is a part of the psychology part of it, which illustrates that the law cannot remedy all societal ills. And also the fact that the issue of domestic violence is not a legal problem, sometimes it's a psychological problem. So there will be an understanding that when you deal with that victim, you must also realize there's something that they call cycle of violence, that psychologists say this person is not in a cycle. So you have to be patient with this person when they come and cancel, and so on and so forth. That's the only thing that I think about at the moment.
Thank you. Chair, lastly, in response to a previous question, you indicated that you're only able to give a prima facie view on the performance of the current public protector. Thank you. In your answer, elaborated as to why you can only give a prima facie view, but you actually never got around to give us your prima facie view.
That is correct.
Would you now give it to us?
My prima facie view is that fairly good, however, it can be better.
Thank you very much.
again.
Thank you, Chairperson. Advocate Machel, Remelama. I just want to pick up on what Honorable Khan has said. There was a question about do you know any witness on the domestic violence? And you said you are not sure. Now, I want to further say that, ask you, are you aware of any of the demands of the total shutdown? Remember the women that marched over there. Do you know of any of their two demands?
Well, first of all, let me just, Honorable Member, say I don't mean to say there's no weakness in the act. But what I'm trying to say, there's nothing that I can think of that is a weakness at the top of my head at the moment. I am sure there is a weakness, but I can't think of anything at the moment. Now, going back to the total shutdown, I think the first one is a general plea to say women need to be respected. Stop abusing women. Treat women equally. Treat women as your partner, not as your subordinate.
Thank you. I think I'm going to leave it there. Can I go to the second question? What is your understanding of the role of the public protector in respect of the requirements of the executive members ethics act?
Her responsibility is to investigate cabinet deputy, MECs, cabinet members, deputy ministers, MECs, and to report on their actions. You want me to go further? Well, to report on their actions when they are unethical.
Thank you. Let's go to the next one. What is your? I'm going to ask this question, noting that you know Section 182 of the Public Protector, and I'm going to be asking your question. What is your view? In fact, what in your view are some of the key challenges that are in the office of the Public Protector, and what are you maybe? What would be your suggestion? Noting what other honourable members have been saying about the challenges that are there in the office with the Deputy Public Protector, noting that it was not the first one. Remember, in the previous one, there was a challenge. Now, for you going there, we want to actually tell us, suggest, what is it that you can do better?
I really think at this stage there should be an intervention from some professional, something like a boss berat, to kind of organize teamwork, starting with the two. Team building exercise, that's what I mean. Because clearly, based on what we hear from the media, there are some tensions there.
Is it on?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, the last one will be, what do you think that the Constitution requires of the Public Protector be both independent and impartial?
Come again, Honourable?
I'm saying that what do you think that the Constitution requires that the Public Protector be both independent and impartial?
I think she can only be impartial if she's independent. And for me, independence means financial independence. Independence means institutional independence. Once she has that kind of independence, she can be able to exercise her role impartially. Because why? She's also non-partisan. She's not taking sides. She's doing her job without any interference.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Catherine.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have a short and easy question. I want to know, ma'am, that you don't have any relations on the political parties and even in the public protector that you want to deputize.
I don't have any relations with her or with any political party. No, ma'am, I am not a member of any political party. I'm non-partisan. And secondly, I don't have a relationship with a public protector.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Lastly, Honorable Judge.
Thank you, Chair. In 5 minutes, I just want to get the best out of you. Have you researched and understand the office of the public protector that you want to be part of?
Right.
Okay, let's get this. Did you make any research?
I did.
Thank you. What's the budget of that office?
The budget
of that office?
I think it's 1.2 billion, including the provinces. I read where they talked about social grants.
In the public protector's office?
Yes.
Social grants?
Yes, they talked about grants, which are monetary grants which are given to provinces. So I assume that that includes the entire office, including even those that are in the suburb office.
That's pause there. The total budget of that office is 384 million. That's the budget.
Okay.
That's far from the bigger. The budget is just for each. Because you have started to research that office. That office is made up of 3 programs. Can you share with us those 3 programs of that office?
The 3 programs,
yes.
No, I'm not aware of the 3 programs.
That's fine. We'll tell you offline. It was my 5 minutes. Let's get to the next point. So, if you don't know the programs, you don't know the budget, how did you get to what you call prima facie things about that office? You said it's fairly good. So on what basis were you saying that? When you don't know the budget, when you don't know the programs, on what basis did you get to that point?
I got to that point based on the cases that have been before the courts. And the reason why I said prima facie view is because I'm not aware of everything that the public protector has done.
Okay, let's pause. At least for this interview,
mm-hmm.
Is it fair for me to say I would have expected you to have started what's happening in that office, including the annual government plan and annual report? Have you looked at any of those?
I did look on the budget issue.
The one you said is a bigger.
Which talked about provinces.
Okay, let's leave that. You might have looked at a document. Let's try to read it. Because if that budget doesn't belong there. My next point, and I want you to be first right here, just give me 2 witnesses that are arising out of that office. You claim to be part of this office.
Yes.
Surely you would have wanted to understand what is it that you need to improve, what failure you bring in.
You mean the witnesses coming from the office?
Witnesses of that office.
I think I have a concern with the public respect. Because I don't think that people at that level should be hanging their linen in the public like that. And bringing, I think if they have issues,
okay.
They should raise them internally.
Thank you.
That is my main concern.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the prima facie and the factual pronouncement by the last court of the land,
mm-hmm.
on that office in relation to the personal costs that were conveyed from the public protector.
Yeah.
What's your view about that? Do you think that was fair, that was really heavy for her, or you think that was a proper thing to do?
That was a decision of the Constitutional Court.
Yes.
The highest court.
As I've just told you now, yes.
Yeah. I mean, who am I to challenge what the Constitutional Court is saying? That is the apex court in the land. If they took that decision, it's because that is the correct decision. And they took that decision based on evidence.
Thank you. My last point, sir. From what we've been talking, so just share honestly with us, why must we, as this committee, appoint you amongst other candidates that have come before us, having listened to what you have presented? Why must we do that?
I think you should appoint me because I'm qualified.
Yes, I know that.
I have extensive experience. I have a passion to do the work. I am a hard worker. I understand the running of government. I'm a fit and proper person. One of the requirements is that the DPP is someone who should have elected. I've done that. I'm triple qualified for the position.
Oh, wow. Jay, this is my very last. Triple qualified, fine. This is my last word. This is my view of you when I get this. That in all the positions that you have been, very senior positions, that you perhaps don't take us seriously by submitting to us when you have access to computer and everything else in your handwriting that I'm not able to read actually. So could you not have done it better? Does this reflect your work ethic?
Not really. People that have worked with me, they know that I'm a hard worker.
I did not work with you. I wouldn't know.
Yes, no, but honorable member, I think that for you to conclude that I did not take you seriously, that's incorrect.
Okay.
I didn't know that it's mandatory for me to type. Perhaps it could have made it easier.
Yeah.
And in my view, I think my handwriting is legible. And I tried to make it legible.
Okay.
But I didn't know that it's mandatory. I didn't know that it's something that can be used against me.
Nobody said it will be used. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hi. I'm Wilma Neo Griffin. But you're not hearing my voice. I'm using a sign language interpreter. Now, you already answered my first question relating to the Chapter 9 institution, but my second question was, if you look at the mandate of the public protector, and the possibility that there's either duplication or overlapping of functions with other Chapter 9 institutions, what is your view on that? Is there an overlapping, and what will you do in that office to avoid the overlapping and duplication of functions?
Indeed, honourable member, there is overlapping, though I must mention that the mandate of the public protector is wider than other Chapter 9 institutions. It's more encompassing, whereas others is more specific. Like with your gender commission, if I may to give an example, they concentrate mainly on gender issues, and so on and so forth. So what is it that I can do to avoid the overlap? I think that I've been made to understand during my research that they do have a forum where they discuss these issues. So probably out of those forums is then that they can decide on what each will focus on mainly, even if it means that the public protector in some instances may have to refer issues that are more relevant or more specifically dealt with other Chapter 9 institutions to them.
Thank you. One more question, Jay. In your experience working with mental health issues, I would like to ask you a question with regard to that. Mental health issues is not taken seriously in this country because of the stigma attached to it with people who have mental illnesses or mental health issues. People try to avoid it and they just don't understand it. If you are appointed into this office as the Deputy Public Protector, what will you do, learning from your experience with regard to the mental health issue, to assist people on the ground with mental health issues too?
I would say education. Because it's very important that mental health care users, or the status per se, that those users be destigmatized, because there's a lot of stigma around that. Even their families, they don't know how to handle them because they don't understand it. So I think it will be very important that families, members of the public, be educated around this issue.
Thank you, Che.
Thank you very much. One question.
A very, very short question, Che. I think it's something that I think is very important to be put on record. Advocate Marcello, we are looking for a fit and a proper deputy public protector of South Africa. And the elements that define fit and proper as a concept is honesty. So we expect that candidates must at all times be honest with us. I'm not saying you are dishonest. Please don't worry. I want to check that during your tenure in the Bophuthatswana military force, did they make you, remember you said you were not conscientized at that time, did they make you do anything that had compromised or would have compromised the genuine strategy of the black majority against injustices of the time?
No, they didn't. You must remember, Honorable Member, that I was appointed as a lawyer. So I only did legal work. I was not a member of intelligence. I was not anything. I was just a lawyer. When the Defense Force is sued, as I said originally, I was appointed as a civil claims specialist. I would just facilitate that process between the Defense Force and the State Attorney. By the way, I must also mention that those of us who were lawyers, were not trusted by the system at that time, at the time when I arrived, because the coup was spearheaded by the legal unit. So much so, they went to an extent of making it a point that the legal unit is headed by a military police, a white military police, not a lawyer. Because the lawyers were a problem. The lawyers are the ones that, as you grow in the profession, you become aware that there's something wrong. You know, when you grow in Bophuthatswana, it was not a choice. The system was imposed on us. Where should I go if I come from Taung? The government somewhere decides that we are going to give black South Africans 13% of Arab land. I was not part of that decision. I was not part of the decision that created the TBVC state. It was imposed on all of us.
That's great, Chair.
That's one question.
Yes, no, Chair, I wanted to say.
I think we still have to go to the house and we will be really emerging from the decision too. So I think let's stick to that. Thank you very much for honoring us with your presence, for accepting to be interviewed, for wanting to serve our nation. We really thank you. But if I may ask you a question, do you, let me put it this way, what is your view of this interview process? What is the answer?
Well, it was challenging. But I think it was fair.
intend to conclude this matter very soon, and before we adjourn for the December holidays, we would have concluded the matter, so you will know with your fate very soon.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Melan.
Honourable members, I propose that we...